From LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
From Louisville Public Media. Support for this podcast comes from Kindred Healthcare, specializing in rehabilitation and long-term acute care services for 30 years. Questions about care after a hospital stay can be answered by speaking with a registered nurse at 1-866-KINDRED. And from KTC Building, seamlessly blending the classic character of older structures with 21st century amenities and technologies. Residential and commercial remodeling projects of any size. Details at KyleThompsonCompany.com.
According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, Kentucky has a workforce of about 2 million people. They work in manufacturing, construction, information technology, agriculture, and many other fields. What does the future hold for these workers? And what about those in the coal industry or those who are being replaced by automation? What effect has the state's right-to-work law had on labor unions and economic development? I'm Rick Howlett. Today on WFPL's In Conversation, we'll talk about the state of labor and workers in Kentucky, and we'll get up to date on some of the labor-related reporting we've been doing recently, specifically on worker safety and on the coal industry. And we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us with your labor-related question or comment. Labor in Kentucky, coming up on In Conversation.
This is a pivotal moment for the West End of Louisville, but is it revitalization or gentrification?
Any improvement they do around here has got to be better.
They're not really asking us, do we want it, do we need it, and can we benefit by it?
The rents are going to rise so fast that they're going to have to leave.
Here Today, a new podcast, will track the changes in West Louisville and how they affect the people who call it home. Follow us at heretodaypodcast.org.
Welcome to WFPL's In Conversation, where we get program support from Kindred Healthcare. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, Labor Day is still more than a couple of weeks away, but today we're going to talk about labor, workers in Kentucky and the region, and the places that employ them, the unions that represent many of them, and the future. And joining us are Professor Arianna Levinson from the Brandeis School of Law at the University of Louisville. Her focus includes labor and employment law. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Bill Londrigan is here. He's the president of the Kentucky State AFL-CIO, a collection of labor unions nationwide representing more than 12 million workers. Bill, good to have you.
Great to be here.
Welcome to Eleanor Klibanoff. You've heard her name on our airwaves once or twice, I think. She's a journalist with the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting based here at WFPL. Her series, Fatal Flaws, How Kentucky is Failing Its Workers, in collaboration with the Ohio Valley Resource and the Center for Public Integrity, focused on worker safety, worker fatalities that went uninvestigated, and the effect of deregulation on worker safety. And we're going to hear some of her reporting a little bit later. Eleanor, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
A little later, we're going to talk with Sydney Bowles. She's a journalist with Ohio Valley Resource. That's a regional journalism collaborative reporting on economic and social change in Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia. Sydney is based at WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, and has been covering the coal industry, most recently the fallout from the bankruptcy of the Black Jewel Coal Company. And again, she'll be joining us a little bit later on from Whitesburg. Well, let's start with you, Bill, just for the sake of background for those who may not know. Tell us a little bit more about the Kentucky AFL-CIO and the workers you represent.
All right. The Kentucky AFL-CIO, as you mentioned, is a federation of unions. So we're a union of unions, and we try to bring unions together to speak with one voice on issues and policies that affect working people across the board. So we have members across the Commonwealth of Kentucky in every trade and occupation, in the building trades unions, in the steel industry, automobile industry, public sector workers that do the work for our cities and counties. So we've got a wide range of union membership across Kentucky that we're really proud to represent.
And what do you do as president? What are some of your responsibilities?
Well, my responsibility primarily is to make sure that we're engaging workers in the labor movement and protecting their interests and rights on the job. And that entails legislative and lobbying work, public relations work, mobilization work, organizing work, and getting the message out to the general public like we're trying to do today.
Dr. Levinson, tell us a little bit more about your focus as a faculty member at the U of L School of Law and some of the research and studies that you've been conducting.
So I'm a labor and employment law scholar, and my research focuses both on worker ownership and on labor arbitration. I'm currently drafting articles about both of those topics. But I do try to stay connected with the legal community and with the wider labor community in Kentucky and across the nation. And like Bill, I'm always happy to try and educate the public about labor issues.
And we're going to circle back to Eleanor in just a short while and hear some of her reporting. But let's talk about some labor-related issues. More than 2 years ago, after Republicans took control of the state legislature and the governor's office, Kentucky became the 27th state to enact a so-called right-to-work law or similar legislation. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Bill. In Kentucky, that means an employee would not have to pay a union fee as a condition of employment. But the union is still obligated to represent the worker. Now, supporters have said the law would spur investment as companies find right-to-work states more attractive. It was upheld by a divided Kentucky Supreme Court. Let me ask you at this point, or if you can make a determination, what effect has it had on labor unions?
Virtually none, except for creating contentious relationships with existing collective bargaining employers. We looked at the numbers in terms of the claims that were made prior to the passage that we were going to have this huge influx of all these manufacturing jobs. And, of course, Governor Bevin's been going around touting these, huge numbers of jobs. And then when you look at the statistics that are produced by his own administration, it doesn't even get close to adding up to what he's claiming. And, they produced the report in March of this year and showed that just since February of 2018, more than a year, they only had 2,400 new manufacturing jobs. And those could be jobs that are already here, employees that are already here. So a lot of the claims that were made that we pointed out, had no basis in fact, and we had the statistics and the data from all these other states that had previously passed right to work and show them that there's no nexus, no relationship, no correlation between passing this law and increasing these manufacturing jobs. And when you look at the statistics, it just shows that we were right, that these jobs have not come here and that we also continue to lose jobs in the manufacturing sector.
Now, has it? You say it hasn't really affected union membership?
No, it has not. In fact, the workers of Kentucky, the union members of Kentucky, understand that without a union contract, they're at-will employees and they can be fired for any reason and no reason at all. And they value the collective bargaining protections that are in that contract. They value the health care benefits. They value the job security and the better wages that they get. So the hope of the proponents that there'd be mass exodus of union members from unions has not materialized in Kentucky one bit. And we're really proud of that, and we think that is really a testament to the notion that we have a strong and vibrant labor movement here that people appreciate when they are in a union and that they have the rights that other workers don't have.
Now, under the law, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention it's very hard to find data about the effect of right to work, and we're not at a point yet in the Commonwealth where we can determine that. Some of the contracts are just now, like the Ford contracts, are just coming up for renewal. But something we do know, because the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Federal Bureau, does report these numbers each year. So we do know that in 2017, 9.6% of Kentucky workers belonged to a union. And in 2018, 8.9% of workers belonged to a union. And we also know that in terms of who's represented by a union, which includes members and non-members, as you explained, that in 2017, 12.8% of workers in Kentucky were represented by unions. 2017 and 2018, 11.4%. So we can't show causation or correlation to right to work, but we can see that the number of people represented by unions has decreased significantly more than the ones that belong to unions, which tends to support Bill's assertion that people are not opting out of membership. But what is happening is that union jobs are being lost by plant closures or moving abroad or other economic circumstances.
Plus, there's people retiring as usual. And as Arianna mentioned, the loss of jobs is a big factor, and it continues on. So this, we want to look at jobs on a net basis. And when we look at those statistics that are produced by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, as well as the Workforce and Investment Cabinet, it just doesn't show, it doesn't add up.
I want to make sure I'm clear on the law. Even though I say I choose not to pay the fee and join a union, if I have a problem with the company, is the union still obligated to represent me?
Exactly. And that is a longstanding federal law, and that's where the rub comes in. You know, it's a policy that's designed to divide workers, those that are paying union dues against those that don't on the shop floor and things of this nature. But, you know, when you look at what we do as a union, it's a group of workers. So when we have a group, what do we usually have? We usually have a process to make decisions, and those decisions are based on our democratic process of majority rule. And when a majority of the workers in a worksite decide to unionize, then that has been interpreted as the legal standard for us to have a collective bargaining relationship with an employer. And when we include in that contract language that requires those receiving the benefits to have to pay a fee, a fair share fee or dues to avail themselves to those benefits, that's decided on the basis of majority vote. What they've done here basically is negated the notion that we're an organization that has the same kind of rights as any other organization to have majority rule in a democratic process to decide how we want to administer our policies and our contracts. It's a total infringement on the rights of labor unions and the only organization or type of organization that this law or this type of required free rider protections exist is in labor unions. So that on its face, you would say, is a discriminatory law.
Dr. Levinson, this the suit was filed in response to passage of this law, and a very divided court upheld it. What was the argument as the basis of the lawsuit?
Right. So there were several arguments made by the unions in the lawsuit, but the two that were strongest and which the dissenting members of the court emphasized were that there cannot be special legislation under the Kentucky Constitution. So you cannot apply a rule to one individual or group of individuals or location that you do not apply evenly across the board. And this rule applies to unions, but does not apply to similar organizations. For instance, the Bar Association, which Kentucky attorneys must join, and they must pay their fees to the Bar Association. And if they're not, they cannot practice law in Kentucky. So now we will start to see challenges to those laws as well. But the other one was actually a smaller issue about emergency legislation. And there weren't very good reasons put forth to show there was an emergency for implementing the law immediately. And I personally think this is problematic because now we're seeing it crop up in other areas and other lawsuits where the legislature is legislating and saying that it's an emergency and able to implement laws more quickly and perhaps with less foresight than they might otherwise be able to.
Bill, you've probably been watching Right to Work in other states. I covered this passage in Indiana. Has the result been pretty much the same as it was in Kentucky?
Absolutely. And we go back to the example we had in Oklahoma. I believe that was in the early 90s. You know, the study showed that even after they passed Right to Work, their manufacturing employment actually declined. You know, there's so many other factors that are involved with employment in manufacturing sector, you know, and there are global issues and there are national issues. And that has a lot to do with whether or not we have high employment in manufacturing, a whole lot more than anything to do with Right to Work.
I think that one of the best studies came from the University of Illinois' labor and employment relations, and they studied Indiana, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and what they found was unionization was reduced by 2.1% in states that adopted Right to Work, and that there were also lower hourly wages, 2.6%. And almost all of the surveys do find that right to work leads to lower hourly wages. There's a dispute about whether outside of the manufacturing sector jobs are created. But even in those instances, the pay does not benefit the hourly workers.
We are talking labor and labor issues on in conversation on 89.3 WFPL. After a break, we're going to check in with Eleanor Klibanoff from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting on her reporting on worker safety in Kentucky. That's all coming up right after this break on In Conversation, 89.3 WFPL.
Communities across this country are losing their most reliable sources of local news. Well, fortunately, public radio is still going strong, and that's thanks to listeners who donate. I'm David Green. Please support local and national journalism.
Support now at WFPL.org.
Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL, where today we're talking about labor, the state of labor in Kentucky, labor unions, Kentucky's workforce, worker safety, and whatever you'd like to talk about. We do want to invite you to join our conversation. 502-814-TALK is our number, 502-814-8255. Our guests are Bill Londrigan, who is president of the Kentucky State AFL-CIO, Arianna Levinson, professor of law at the University of Louisville, and we're joined here in the studio by Eleanor Klibanoff from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, Sydney Bowles of the Ohio Valley Resource, who's been reporting extensively on coal mining and the coal industry and the Black Jewel bankruptcy, will be joining us in just a short while. Again, our number 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. You have an opinion about right to work? You have an opinion about labor unions? Are you an employer, an employee? We'd love to hear from you. 502-814-8255. We're also on Twitter. WFPL News is our handle. And you can also reach us through Facebook as well. Let's turn now to Eleanor Klibanoff from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, who's been doing an extensive amount of work on worker safety in Kentucky. First of all, Eleanor, just give us a little background about fatal flaws. You're reporting on worker safety, and walk us up to your report on changes that have been promised as a result of a federal audit and your reporting.
Sure. So Fatal Flaws was a months-long investigation done by the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, the Ohio Valley Resource, and the Center for Public Integrity that found that Kentucky had failed to properly investigate worker fatalities for nearly 2 years. That was a finding in a federal audit that really blew the whistle on a lot of problems facing Kentucky's OSHA agency, and our reporting sort of backed up those findings as well. So we told the stories of a lot of these families that had been affected by this, and families that had really been fighting for answers from the labor cabinet in the wake of their loved ones' deaths. In a lot of these cases, they later found out that eyewitnesses weren't interviewed. In some cases, the employee who died was blamed for their own death when, in fact, there were worker safety violations that could have been held to account. So we did that series. We tried to get the labor cabinet to comment beforehand. They declined multiple times. And once we did the story, they continued to decline to comment, although Labor Secretary David Dickerson did write an op-ed in the Lexington Herald Leader that alluded to some changes that they were making. Finally, a few months ago, we got an interview with the state's new Commissioner for Workplace Safety, Dwayne Depp, who took over in the wake of the federal audit and laid out some pretty significant changes that they were planning to make. When we sat down with Commissioner Depp, he had not yet met with any of the families that were affected, any of the families that had been seeking answers actively from his agency for years in some cases. A few months later, or a few weeks later at that point, April 28th, which is Workers' Memorial Day around the country, a day to memorialize those who have been lost or injured on the job, we went to this annual Workers' Memorial Day event honoring Grant Oakley, who was a 17-year-old who died on his second day of work, and the company received almost no penalty from the state after he died. So we went to that just to sort of do a wrap-up story, and once we got there, Commissioner Depp and Labor Secretary Dickerson showed up to talk with the families for the first time.
And let's play that now.
In the lobby of the Grand Theater in Lancaster, Kentucky, Mike and Pam Oakley are setting up their annual event. There's a table with photos of their son, Grant, mementos and memories of a life cut too short.
In 2015, we lost our son, Grant, 17 years old, on his second day at work. He was still in high school, but he wanted to work.
And right across the road from our house, where we live and raised him.
This is Mike and Pam's story. How their son died on the job, and how the State Worker Safety Agency failed to properly investigate his death. For years, they've been telling this story to anyone who would listen. The state never did. Until today.
There he is right there.
Great. Dwayne Depp.
My pleasure.
My pleasure. So
Depp is Kentucky's Commissioner of Workplace Standards. He took over in July 2018 after a critical federal audit found that the state had failed to properly investigate nearly every single workplace fatality in a two-year period.
Hello, how are you?
Yes, ma'am. I'm David Dickerson. I'm Governor's Secretary of Labor.
I see your picture.
Depp brought his boss, David Dickerson, and federal state OSHA coordinator Chuck Stribling.
I hope that we can build a future together.
Absolutely. I can guarantee you we'll be able to.
Well, we're working at it, I'll tell you.
Well, we're going to work with you.
Absolutely.
We're happy to have your input. Please don't be bashful.
Oh, I am. As long as you get to know me, you'll see that I'm not.
In a recent interview with KYCIR, Depp admitted for the first time that the state had mishandled fatality investigations prior to his tenure. He laid out changes that he has implemented, like salary increases to retain inspectors, additional training requirements, and creating what he calls a culture of accountability. At that point, he had yet to meet with any of the families involved in those mishandled investigations. But just a few weeks later, he showed up at the Workers' Memorial Day event to share his plans with the Oakleys directly.
What we're doing in our department now, just really going back to a lot of the basics, you know, making sure that we know how to write a report, we know how to interview, we know how to do all those things.
Since the day his son died in 2015, Mike Oakley has been fighting for these kinds of reforms.
Well, you have no idea what this means to see you three standing here. You have no idea.
In the long run, Oakley wants more than just a drop-by visit. He wants to be part of the change, including helping to educate state inspectors on how to work with grieving families. Depp agrees to a follow-up visit to hear him out.
Here's my card, okay. And it's actually got my cell phone number on it. It's my personal cell phone. Okay. Use that anytime you want to, anytime you have questions about anything.
The three state officials take their seats in the Grand Theater, the only suits in a crowd of work shirts and motorcycle vests. They're surrounded by the friends and families of those who have died on the job over the last few years, the living victims of those mishandled investigations. Workers' Memorial Day is held every April 28th. Chosen to celebrate the day Federal OSHA was created in 1971. Around the country, groups gather to read the names of workers who have died on the job in the last year.
Jordan Doyle, Andy Schlanding, David Robinson.
Andy Sims, the Commonwealth's attorney for Garrett and Jessamine County, does the honors here.
Collins, John Williams, John Fugate.
Mike Oakley sits by the side of the stage, choked up once again. This crusade he's been on the last few years is for Grant. But it's also for these people, these names, and the loved ones they leave behind. He's fighting so no one else will have to, and he has no plans to stop. But for the first time in a long time, Mike Oakley's hopeful that he's finally fighting with the state rather than against it. For the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, I'm Eleanor Klibanoff.
And Eleanor, this you reported this back in May, correct? So, mm-hmm. So what has transpired since then, if anything?
So since then, the big thing that has happened is, you know, there were a lot of promises made, and every year the federal OSHA agency does an audit of Kentucky's OSHA agency as a state-run plan. So we got this year's audit that reflects last year. It's a fiscal year conundrum. And so it does reflect a period that occurred mostly before a lot of these changes were able to take effect. The big news out of that audit was that for the first time in many years, Kentucky had no new findings, so no new major areas for improvement. But a lot of the audit was sort of speculative. It basically said, Commissioner Depp has taken over. He's made a lot of these promises. We think they're on the right track. We're not going to ding you anew for things you haven't had a chance to fix yet, but we will be looking again very closely in the next year.
And Bill Londrigan from the AFL-CIO. Talk about how unions get involved in helping this shape policy and worker
sure.
safety.
Well, I just want to thank Eleanor for the work that she did on the report. And talking about the Workers' Memorial Days, which was something that organized labor has started many years ago. And we have numerous of these events around the country as well here in Kentucky. And one of the problems that we recognized when I talked with Eleanor about it was that we weren't getting the data necessary to actually memorialize and commemorate those that were killed and died right. on the job during that year. And we saw this huge discrepancy between those statistics, and we were so glad that Eleanor followed up on that and hopefully see some changes, because, you know, to disregard the fatalities that occur is a major, you know, oversight or major problem on the part of the state government, and I'm glad it might be getting corrected or at least addressed in some manner. But what we do a lot is a lot of work in lobbying legislation. That's a lot of the way the public policy, you know, where the rubber hits the road, where laws are passed, and we engage our legislators and our members to try and talk to folks that are elected to make sure they're representing the interest of workers on a daily basis on issues that range from workers' compensation, unemployment insurance, safety and health on the job, wages, pensions, job security, and all a variety of issues that are important to having a good standard of living and having a safe workplace and having job security. So we do a lot of stuff with the legislative process, as I mentioned, as well as talking to the general public and getting our word out through various media and social media and things of this nature to try and make sure that folks understand that they have the right to organize a union at their workplace, that their rights can be protected, and that they should be encouraging each other at the workplace to join together, as we have seen around the country now. And I might just add, Ariana is probably familiar with all of the different groups of workers in the fast food industry, in the service industry, at Amazon, that are getting so fed up with those low wages and that lack of respect and dignity on the job that they're joining together and actually going on strike and picketing, just like we have seen in the past in labor history. We believe that we're on the verge of a large-scale movement to protect the interests and rights of workers on the job here in America.
And that brings us to a question, a Twitter question from Joy, who says, I believe in the power of unions. How can I support them even if I don't work for one?
Well, you can actually have a positive discussion and talk to your fellow employees and workers as well, to talk to them about what the union movement is about and how important it is for them to protect their rights on the job. That would be something that you could do, and, you know, support elected representatives and candidates that support the right of workers to organize and bargain collectively and protect the interests of workers.
You're listening to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL. We're talking about labor in Kentucky and labor unions and associated topics. Bill Londrigan is here, he's the president of the Kentucky State AFL-CIO. Ariana Levinson is a professor of law at the University of Louisville. She joins us in the studio. Eleanor Klibanoff from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting joins us as well. She's been reporting on workers' safety in Kentucky. In a little while, we're going to be joined by Sydney Bowles, who is a journalist with Ohio Valley Resource, been reporting extensively on the coal industry, especially the Black Jewel bankruptcy and the actions that some miners have taken since then. 502-814-TALK is the number to call if you have a question or comment about our topic today. And let's go to the phones. Ira from Louisville is on the line. Hi, Ira. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. I very much appreciate this discussion. It's very seldom that ordinary working class people have their representatives on radio or television to talk. I have a couple of comments and a question, if I may. First of all, I think it's most important on a general level to say, who gave us the weekend? The labor movement gave us the weekend. My grandparents came to the United States around 1910. My grandma worked in a factory, a large factory, and there was a sign, if you don't come in on Sunday, don't come in on Monday. The fight was not just for a 40-hour week. It was for something like a 50- or 60-hour week. And it was the labor movement that gave us the weekend. It didn't come automatically. I was very interested in the point that was made about investigating workplace fatalities. There shouldn't be half as many workplace fatalities. There should actually be no workplace fatalities. And only the labor movement can insist on this happening. And the labor-backed candidates. This is not an aberration or a misordering of priorities. Last point I want to make is that I used to rule on cases, discrimination cases, of the old Louisville and Jefferson County Human Relations Commission. And then a few years ago, I sat as a commissioner. And I can tell you that the needs of ordinary working people, men and women, are not adequately being addressed, particularly in the area of racism and sexism and ageism and homophobia and gay discrimination. And it's the labor movement that needs to push for these things to happen. And I would say to the speakers, God bless you all, and I wish you luck.
All right, Ira, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate that. He mentioned the weekends being kind of a product of the labor movement, Bill. I'm interested in hearing about the effect of foreign companies that invest in the U.S. and do have maybe different work traditions, work schedules that they follow. What are negotiations like with the companies that from countries that where they, you know, we work on?
It can be a little difficult. Yeah. Can be a little different. When you look at the countries that we're, you know, primarily recipients of investment, we're talking about Japan, we're talking about Europe, we're talking about Germany. You know, the variety of different countries, and these countries, you know, they have different relationships with their workers. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's interesting that, like, when they come here, their perspective on their relationship with those workers gets topsy-turvied into an anti-union perspective, which we've seen over and over and over again. You take Germany, for instance, where they have this long-term, legally obligated relationship with their unions and co-determination, where union representatives sit on the boards of directors of these large corporations, like Volkswagen, for instance, and then they come down here to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and engage in one of the biggest anti-union campaigns that we've ever seen. This has happened over and over again. When they come to America, they get this notion that, you know, there's a war on workers here, there's a war on trade unions, and that they need to engage in it in order for them to remain in this competitive position. And they're encouraged by a lot of these politicians and business owners whose only goal here is to create, you know, more wealth for the corporation and their shareholders and leave the workers out. I mean, that's basically the equation. And that's a lot of what is going on in the country right now with this foreign investment and how it relates to, you know, to relations. But, you know, you can't talk in totally broad terminology or terms that there are places where, you know, foreign ownership has been, you know, met with a positive relationship with their members, and that workers have, you know, been able to engage in collective bargaining on a fair, decent way and achieved results with those other companies. But I think in general what we've seen is that companies come to America and they get poisoned by this anti-union, anti-labor environment, and then they facilitate that by hiring those attorneys that, you know, work to thwart unionization. And Arianna, I think, is very familiar with all that.
Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize the role that laws really do play in this. So the laws in Germany are different than the laws in the United States. The laws in Japan are different from the laws in Germany and the United States. And historically, in the United States, in the big picture, our laws prioritize property and contract. So in relation to something Ira said as well, there's not any legal protections for things like your basic need of food, clothing, housing. And when you look at things from this perspective, then you can see how the law can only be helpful if there's a social movement pushing behind the law to implement it in a certain way. And since here in the U.S., the labor laws tend to not be very good at helping workers join together and join into unions and collectively bargain. And so because of that, companies that operate here are able to do what the law permits them to do.
And then some. And as a labor attorney, you would know that those laws are violated routinely in order to thwart unionization. You know, fire the person that's leading the charge and try to take the momentum out of any kind of a movement forward by the worker. So that's a routine procedure that's used to try and thwart unionization, continues to this day. You know, we just heard from this guy that runs this Barstool. Is that the name of
Barstool
it?
Barstool Sports, yes. Yeah.
Barstool Sports. Anybody that said anything about joining a union, what do you say? I'll just fire them all.
Right, on Twitter, he responded to them announcing a union push.
That would be illegal, wouldn't it?
Well, it's under, it's unlawful,
yes. Right. The remedies aren't very strong, and the process takes a long time. But Bill mentioned earlier that we are seeing worker activism across the country and here in Kentucky.
We need to take a break. We'll be back with much more. We're talking labor on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL.
We get support for In Conversation from our sponsor, Kindred Healthcare, specializing in rehabilitation and long-term acute care services for 30 years. Questions about care after a hospital stay can be answered by speaking with a registered nurse at 1-866-KINDRED.
In Conversation wouldn't be possible without you. To support the work we do, visit WFPL.org/supportinconversation or look for the link in our show notes. Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett. Today we're talking about the state of labor in Kentucky, workforce, labor unions, labor laws. And with us in the studio are Bill Londrigan, president of the Kentucky State AFL-CIO, Arianna Levinson, who's a professor of law at the University of Louisville, focusing on labor and employment. Eleanor Klibanoff from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting is with us as well. She's been doing a lot of work recently on worker safety in Kentucky. And in just a moment, we're going to check in with Sydney Bowles out in Whitesburg, Kentucky. She's a journalist for Ohio Valley Resource and has been reporting extensively recently on the coal industry. But first, I want to we had a Twitter question who wanted your all's thoughts on the new Secretary of Labor appointed by President Trump, and I assume that is Eugene Scalia, correct? Bill, your thoughts on that appointment?
Well, I don't think that he's what we would consider to be a favorable person to the interest of working people and to organized labor in general. It remains to be seen what exactly, you know, he comes up with, but, you know, his record of, you know, cases involving Wall Street and protecting the interests of Wall Street bankers and financiers is well known. So we don't think this guy's going to be a great, you know, representative to protect, you know, our rights on the job.
Eleanor, you've been reporting all about state safety regulations. What have we seen under President Trump thus far?
Sure. Kentucky is a state-run OSHA plan, so that means that we regulate ourselves, but the federal OSHA regulates Kentucky's
right.
OSHA plan. And so there is a big effect on Kentucky. The Department of Labor is having very similar problems that Kentucky's OSHA agency is having. The number of compliance, safety, and health officers, people who inspect workplaces in the Trump administration, has fallen to an all-time low, about 870 inspectors. That number was over 1,000 during the Obama administration. So, and that matters because, you know, we set, or federal OSHA sets the standards that Kentucky must be at least as effective as. And so when they roll back, and there's a lot of different safety regulations that are being discussed about rolling back or not being implemented, and Kentucky permission to roll back those as well. And as we see, Kentucky historically, well, at least recently in the last couple of administrations, has not often exceeded federal regulations. We have just matched them. So that's the effect.
Go ahead. Okay. Well, I was just going to just briefly say that, you know, we talk about these OSHA inspectors before they were even cut back. The ability of them to inspect workplaces is pretty darn small. We've got millions and millions of workplaces, and how many inspectors do we have now?
Nationally, 870.
870. So you can see, you know, the priorities of, you know, protecting the interest of workers and their safety on the job is pretty low.
I will say for the first time, Kentucky this year met its benchmark for the number of OSHA inspectors it is supposed to have. That benchmark was set in 1987. So for the first time, we have met that, which I believe is 23 safety inspectors.
And there's studies that show when you have laws that just set minimum wage or set minimum safety standards or anti-discrimination principles, if you don't have a union in your workplace that can monitor for violations, they're likely to go unenforced. And I also wanted to say that one of the violations that the federal OSHA found for Kentucky OSH was that they were not taking any complaints that were filed online.
Yes.
And while certainly our resources need to first go to stopping fatalities, it is really unacceptable that there aren't enough resources and enough investigators to look into valid complaints that are filed online.
They also were not taking non-formal complaints, which mean complaints that were coming from outside of the employee you have to be employed to get that complaint. And they say that they are now going to begin taking those, but that was a huge gap.
Just if I could just follow up, you know, we talked about workplace fatalities, which are, you know, those that have the proximate cause of death as something related directly on the job. We are missing one of the biggest fatalities that occurs on the job, which is occupational diseases. You know, here in Kentucky, of course, we're all familiar with what we call pneumoconiosis or black lung disease. We also have mesothelioma, silicosis. Thousands and thousands of workers are killed or die each year from those progressive fatal diseases. And there's very little done to try and, you know, protect their interests or compensate them while they're still alive. And we've just seen these terrible reports of how, you know, there's only two doctors now in the entire state of Kentucky that are qualified under this new law, House Bill 2, which stripped so many other pieces of workers' compensation away. Only two doctors in the entire Commonwealth that are right now certified to do black lung evaluations when we have, you know, one of the biggest clusters of black lung disease finding its way into Kentucky, West Virginia, and Virginia right now. And we've got such a lack of focus on trying to protect those workers and compensate them adequately and making sure that their needs are taken care of while they're suffering from this fatal disease.
All right, let's with that in mind, let's go out to Sydney Bowles. You're listening to In Conversation, incidentally, on 89.3 WFPL. We're talking about the state of labor in Kentucky. Sydney Bowles is a journalist with Ohio Valley Resource. That's a regional journalism collaborative reporting on economic and social change in Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia. And she joins us now from Whitesburg, Kentucky. Sydney, thanks for waiting.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, I know you've been covering the mining industry extensively, and especially the Black Jewel coal mining company bankruptcy, which we have seen miners not getting back pay and not getting or checks bouncing and that sort of thing, and some miners taking action in Harlan County, blockading railroad tracks there. Tell us what's the latest with that out in Cumberland, Kentucky.
Yeah, so the miners who have been blockading this railroad track are going on about 2.5 weeks now, standing out through rain, through heat, to protest lack of payment. You know, they've gone without pay for about a month of work for about 6 weeks now, and this has been through a chaotic bankruptcy process, through the sale of the mines that they were working at to a new company. And they say that, you know, almost going on 3 weeks in, they're not backing down until they get the money that they're owed.
And you've been talking to them. How are they holding out?
Well, I think steam is dying down a little bit, especially with kids going back to school. Younger families are less able to spend time on the tracks. But there is a steady contingent of folks who take shifts throughout the day to make sure that the protest camp is staffed, is running. Community supporters continue to bring by food and water to support them. And even as energy is waning a bit, the anger and frustration that spurred the protest remains really strong, I think.
So let's go back to the bankruptcy. Where do we stand with that? Is there any resolution in sight that they could get some of the money they're owed?
Yes, they will get at least some of the money that they're owed. Through the bankruptcy sale process, the mines that these folks were working at were sold to a company out of Tennessee called Copperglow. And as part of that sale, Copperglow agreed to put up $450,000 to cover miners' back wages, or at least a part of it. And then there's a potential for an additional $550,000 following that, depending on some conditions within Copperglow. Even that total of $1 million will not cover all of the money that's owed to these miners, including healthcare expenses, including 401k money. There are all sorts of areas where these miners have really lost out that they may never recover. But there's some sense that they will at least get something, and so they're waiting on that now.
And they have been getting some help from others in the community, really from a lot of different people, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think from the very beginning, there was just an outpouring of support, both locally and I think around the country. There was a really fun, for a couple of days there, they put out a call directing folks to call into a Pizza Hut. So folks from around the country who are not close to Harlan County were paying for pizzas and then having them delivered to the miners at the blockade. So that was pretty fun for a while. We've also seen sort of spontaneous concerts come by. Local musicians will come and just play music to keep people entertained. We see cornhole games. We see, you know, kids playing football. And we do see local politicians as well stopping by just to show their support.
Now, of course, this is part of a bigger trend we've seen in the coal mining industry in recent years. Talk a little bit about how that has affected people out in your part of the state because there have been job losses, obviously, and less excise tax money. How are they dealing with it?
You know, folks here in eastern Kentucky are really divided on the role that coal mining will play in the future of this region. You know, as many folks know, coal has been in a decline for a number of years now, in part due to federal environmental regulations, but mostly because of the availability of cheap natural gas. And so I think there was a lot of hope that President Donald Trump would be able to turn the industry around. But I think it's fair to say that since his election, that hasn't really come to pass. So there is a sense that there needs to be a shift in some capacity, but coal mining has really been the only profession in eastern Kentucky that could provide a comfortable middle-class lifestyle. And understandably, a lot of families a lot of miners really identify with that legacy. So some miners do intend to continue working in coal, but I will say a good contingent of the Black Jewel miners are actually moving to Alabama to continue coal mining there. Others plan to go back to school. But other miners told me, you know, I can't afford to go back to school. I have kids that I need to feed. Now I can't wait till I get a degree to provide for my family. And then you're right. Yeah, aside from the challenges facing individual miners, it's also a struggle for these communities. For a long time, the excise tax did fund infrastructure and sort of basic civil services like trash pickup. And with a decline in that revenue, communities really are struggling to provide those services. And I think there's a sense that as the industry continues to contract, those problems are only going to get more severe.
You may have heard Bill a minute ago talking about black lung disease or similar diseases because of coal mining. Now, you've been reporting on some miners went up to Washington and were trying to preserve the federal Black Lung Disability Trust Fund. Where does that stand now?
Right. So for those who might not know, the federal Black Lung Disability Trust Fund supports health care expenses and living expenses for miners with black lung for whom no responsible coal operator can be identified. And as coal production declines, the tax on coal that funds the trust fund is also declining, which means that there's less revenue going into this fund as you were discussing, the burden on the fund is increasing as this epidemic of black lung continues to worsen, particularly in central Appalachia. So the fund is, the Government Accountability Office has said that if nothing changes, the fund will be $50 billion in debt by 2050. And so the miners were really hoping to urge Congress on this trip to Washington, D.C. to raise the tax on coal that supports the trust fund so that it can continue to be solvent for longer. It's worth pointing out that politicians have promised that if nothing changes, miners won't lose benefits, even if the fund continues to go further into debt. But one of a few things might happen. One thing is that taxpayers could end up bailing out the fund, which would effectively shift the burden for this worsening black lung disease from the coal companies that caused it to the taxpayers. And the other option is that the barrier for accessing these benefits could be lowered, meaning that you would have to be sicker in order to get benefits. And that would mean fewer miners get the financial support that they really depend on when they're disabled by this preventable disease. So coming out of this trip to Washington, there has been some new legislation passed, and I think there's more in the works that we may see. But as usual, all of these pieces of legislation essentially rest on Mitch McConnell to bring them to a vote, and he has not indicated that he's going to do that. So it remains to be seen what pieces of legislation are able to be passed.
We're talking with Sydney Bowles from the Ohio Valley Resource, who's joining us on the phone from Whitesburg, Kentucky. She's been reporting on the coal industry and specifically more recently on the Black Jewel bankruptcy. Also with us in the studio here on In Conversation are Bill Londrigan, president of the Kentucky State AFL-CIO, Ariana Levinson, professor of law at the University of Louisville, and Eleanor Klibanoff with the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, has been doing a lot of work recently on workers' safety. Let's get back to the phone here before we run out of time. Let's go to Horse Ranch, Kentucky. And Tim, first of all, I got to ask you, Tim, where is Horse Ranch, Kentucky?
So it's actually Horse Branch, Kentucky.
Oh, Branch, okay.
Just south of Owensboro, north of Bowling Green.
We're in a little place called Ohio County. My question was to Bill Lundergan. I was just wondering if he could talk about some of the union membership benefits for anybody that might be listening and wanting to potentially, you know, think about joining a union. I'm looking at a Labor Day at the Zoo, picnic, and car show as a USCW member. Our folks are able to get discounted tickets as we're a co-sponsor of this event. I was wondering if there are other events like that and other membership benefits.
Yes, Tim, there's a wide variety of benefits that are available to union members besides what happens at the workplace and in the contract itself. Of course, there are insurance programs. There's automobile programs that give you discounts. There's, you know, of course, the key programs, of course, are superior health care benefits and prescription plans. You know, it just runs the gamut of things that are available for folks to avail themselves when they're in a union. Excuse me. In terms of you know, just that basic protection on the job, to have a grievance procedure, which people that are not in a union don't enjoy. Just some basic protections that make sure folks are treated fairly and not discriminated against for any reason on the job. So you know, better wages, of course. I mean, we've always led the way in wages and such, and that was one of the, you know, getting back to what's happening in the coal industry, the reason why the wages that are being paid miners that are even not in a union are relatively higher than everybody else in the regions, because the United Mine Workers work over the decades to improve those wages and working conditions. So we certainly you know, benefit workers in so many different ways, including the basic right of having a collective bargaining agreement and no longer being an at-will employee.
Tim, thanks for calling us, and I learned something today. It's Horse Branch, Kentucky, in Ohio County. And thanks for calling from Ohio County. We have a Twitter message from John. Are unions finding the right balance between investing and organizing and spending on politicians? Should we work harder on organizing, Bill?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think that's a very good question. You know, it's always a question of resources, and, you know, organizing is an expensive proposition to go out and to, you know, do house calls on hundreds of workers in some cases. So fighting big corporations in court with their, you know, high-paid lawyers and such. So there needs to be a balance, but I think that's a very good point that more organizing needs to be taking place. And I think that once workers understand, and younger workers, as I'm seeing across the country in various industries, the media industry exploding with union membership, younger workers realizing that their options to improve their situation at work are very limited, and their only option to really improve it is through collective bargaining and organizing together.
Are unions are answerable? Is there some sort of governing agency or some sort of regulatory agency that tells them how much they can charge for fees and dues? Or is this left up to their...
That particular issue is left mostly up to the individual local unions or the international unions that make that determination based on the requirements that they have for the resources that they need to represent workers effectively. You know, we often have to hire attorneys and go through arbitration through the grievance procedure, a whole variety of different things that cost a lot of money. Even collective bargaining itself is an expensive proposition. So usually those fees and dues are set at a certain level to make sure that the union can adequately provide those protections and benefits.
Well, federal
law just requires that the fees be reasonable, and they are audited routinely, just like any other entity, a nonprofit or a business. The Department of Labor scours what unions do with their money.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. It's gone by quickly. Thanks to everyone for joining us. Bill Lundergan of the Kentucky State AFL-CIO, Arianna Levinson, Professor of Law at the University of Louisville, Eleanor Klibanoff, Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. You can find her reporting at kycir.org or wfpl.org. And Sydney Bowles with Ohio Valley Resource. Check out their website as well, ovr.org. Thank you all for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thanks to our In Conversation production team, Caitlin Jackson, Brad Yost, Ashley Clark Thompson, and Russell Wells. Our opening and closing theme was composed by Kojin Toshiro. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening. Next time on WFPL's In Conversation, we'll talk about the University of Louisville's pending purchase of Jewish Hospital and other local assets of Kentucky One Health. It's a deal with many moving parts. How will it affect healthcare in Louisville and the region and medical research? Let us know what you think during our discussion of the Jewish Hospital sale on In Conversation, Friday morning at 11 on 89.3 WFPL, with program support from Kindred Healthcare.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.